Hello, this evening I want to talk about Niels Bohr. He comes up all the time at school. He's the major principal scientist that we teach about the atom, atomic physics and chemistry to our children. He's come up with the naive view of the atom, the childhood view of the atom, and so he's wound up to be the principal person that we talk about at school, so we may as well learn more about him. For my part, as a teacher, he's come to my attention over and over again. I've read little bits of articles and gradually built a picture up. And then as I discuss topics, I mention him from time to time and say often I'd like to digress and talk more about him. So this is an occasion where I'll speak more about him. But there's probably a little bit more sinister way in the way we teach him, but I'll get to that at the end of this podcast. This podcast is a member of the universe of Peter Hill Explains, where I talk about things scientific. Just as an aside, the principal thing I'm trying to do is actually develop my podcasting ability as part of my cardiac rehab. Being sort of set to the outside of the teaching system, I've got to try and get back into teaching and talking about things overall. So as I said, Niels Bohr, he's a scientist and he's associated with the atom. The most notable thing, again, I'm talking all this off the top of my head, you'll have to really double-check all these facts. So these are the facts that just float into my head, and I assume that they're right. And you can hear some noise in the back as it's raining in this car as I'm podcasting it. But getting back onto it. So the most famous thing about Niels Bohr, I suppose, is his picture of the atom, a very famous picture of the atom. It's the iconic picture of the atom, a small cluster of grapes with electrons whizzing around the outside. It's a more complex view. You have it on Homer Simpson's nuclear reactor. If you ever see a picture of an atom, they draw the picture of a Bohr-style atom. We formalize it a little bit in school by drawing it as a circle with these radiating circles on the outside. So a cluster of little circles forming, like a bunch of grapes, a three-dimensional cluster, very tiny cluster of the nucleus in the very centre of the atom, the protons and the neutrons. The protons are positive, neutrons are neutral, but together they stick together to overcome electrostatic repulsion. So you've got a whole lot of positive charges which would fly apart. And in Bohr's atom, there are the electrons are very tiny dots, and they're confined to racetracks, circular racetracks, if you would like. So you can almost imagine that as a, or you can imagine it as certain things. I like to imagine it. There's something very evocative of this down here in Penrith. This is Penrith in Australia. We have something called Cables Water Ski Park. And what happens is there's this central motor with a cable on the outside, and you hook yourself up to this cable, grab on the water ski, and it takes you in a circular path around and around this lake on a water ski, and take you over jumps and things like that. The equivalent to this is the atom. There's a positive nucleus, and it's exerting a force on electrons, and it pulls those electrons in a circle. So if you want a more handheld or something to imagine, you can imagine one of those practice golf balls with holes through it. You know, they have the holes with it, so when it flies, it catches the air, so you hit it very hard, but it doesn't go very far. So you can imagine threading a piece of thread through that, and as a ball, and using that ball to swing it around your head, or something rather small. So we know that the electron, or Bohr, found that the electron had a mass of 1,823, off the top of my head. I'm sure that's not the correct answer. But nearly 2,000 times lighter than it. So a gram is 1,000 times lighter than a kilogram. If you're, say, 80 kilograms, for instance, an 80-gram packet, that's, I don't know, a handful of dough, just half a cup of water, less than half, a few sips of water is the weight of an atom compared to your weight. It's similarly thought to be very small, or at least Bohr thought it was very small. Let me try and get you, throw you back in time, into time and place. So Bohr was born in 1895 and died in 1962. A year later, I was born, to give you an idea of that I am actually rather an old codger. But Bohr was born in Denmark. So Denmark is in Europe. So you have Britain, you have beneath Britain, over the channel is France, Germany, in a little sort of cluster of countries sort of sandwiched between Germany, the North Sea, and France. You have Holland, Belgium, and sort of tucked in there is Luxembourg. But if you continue further along towards Russia and probing up as a sort of a peninsula sticking up into the south of Scandinavia, which is Sweden and Norway, you have Denmark. And Denmark is, I suppose, it's got its origins in the Norse, Nordic, or Viking tribes. So the Vikings used to hark, that's where the Vikings came from. So the Denmarks, the Danes, used to have a very large empire. It used to go up until quite recently, taking all of Norway and go around places. The Danes would often, in the time of, I think, 1066, the times of the knights in England that have Danish Vikings would come across. So you can imagine the Vikings but become very Christian over the time. The story with Bohr, for instance, is that he was part of his mother was Jewish, so he was of a Jewish family, although he went into the Christian church. So his dad was at a university, and he was one of three children in Denmark, so you can imagine. At 1900, he was 5 years old, and just coming into university at the time. So 1900, they discovered the electron. He was about 5 years old, and he was coming into university. And Denmark, there, a relatively flat country for you. The capital of Copenhagen. It's got a monarchy, Danish king. It's a Protestant country, largely a Protestant country, yeah, but just getting back to it. So I'm just trying to give you a bit of a background history to it. So he himself was rather sporting. So he was a fit, tall, strapping young lad with a big head. Remember that he had a slightly large head. So one of the things, when you look at pictures of Bohr, he looks to have a big head. So that's an important thing to remember later on in the story. So he was a footballer. His brother was a famous footballer, and they sort of went through university. Denmark wasn't particularly, I think, an ancient, also there's time for famous astronomers and mathematicians. In terms of the physical sciences or the sciences that were evolving at the time, it wasn't a major superpower as compared to Germany. A lot of the advanced ideas were coming out of Germany. So if you like, Denmark was on the peripheral a little bit. And this is important that he went to Copenhagen University, some sort of university there, but managed to do a lot of his work and research in the physics association with the British research. So Britain was still at a very high point of experimental physics or phenomenal physics, sort of classic old physics. So Einstein in Germany was beginning to produce the new generation, the new thinking of physics, which would lead to special relativity through Einstein directly, and eventually, as people began to nut things out, to quantum mechanics, the more advanced science, which all of science has gone along, that German physics, whereas this Danish physics, which we're looking at in the Copenhagen School, is sort of like a rural type of physics, so to speak. Looking at his thesis at university, this is Niels Bohr. So you can imagine this tall, big head, not a huge, stupid looking head, but athletic person who, used his father's laboratories, used his contacts at university to really do some basic physics research, really conjuring things out of nothing. And that sort of really reminds me of Australia, that unless you're extremely lucky here in Australia, you're on the fringe of things, and to do any sort of research, you have to be really inventive, or at least I had to do inventive research in the 80s and 90s and up to, or even through the 2000s, I had to do a lot of creative research, really fashioning things out of the shed, things around the place. So you can imagine Niels Bohr's in the shed producing his work. It's interesting to see the way that he does things. I'll move the story on a little bit. His thesis was to do with what I just consider the most cringeworthy theory. And I suppose it was a first stab at theory, given that the electron was discovered in 1998, the actual identified and the mass and the idea that this is a small glowy thing. A small little speck of dust compared to the nucleus is a small clump where all the matter is, and the electron somehow is a tiny fraction of the mass taking up this whole volume. People were trying to nut that out. So the model that Bohr cut his teeth on is called the Drude model, and of course the Drude model I encountered when I opened up a science textbook that I was teaching, and I had to teach this model, and I thought, where has this come from? I have seen it from time to time, but some lectures have talked about it. So I found that it was a model which came out in 1900, 1901 by this chap called Drude, D-R-U-D-E, and his view was that by magic, metal is a lattice. So a lattice is a regular array. So I suppose a common view of a lattice would be, a lattice fence. That's it. A trellis, which a fence going up, regular crisscross. A lattice would be a piece of graph paper, polka dots on a dress. They're a two-dimensional lattice. A three-dimensional lattice is sort of polka dots rising up in three dimensions, if you can possibly imagine that. So magically, these positive nuclei have decided that I'm going to just magically sit on graphical coordinate points. So one will be at 0, 0, 0, another one will be on 0, 0, 1, and yet another one will be on 1, 1, 1, another one will be on 13. And in all numbers, say 13, 12, 11, there'll be another nucleus there that fills out the entire space of these positive charges. And electrons in the Drude model are these fantastic little particles, because they weren't, gases were too much for them to think of at the time, 1900. And bear in mind that people really didn't know atoms were real until perhaps Einstein went into his papers in 1905. So atoms, people really didn't talk about atoms, but they did talk about what a metal was. And the idea is that you've got this lattice of positive nuclei, positive charges, quite strong positive charges, and the electrons are tiny little specks of dust which are amazingly drawn into this charged cage, and they bounce around the place. They bounce a bit like a pinball machine is to imagine it bouncing in and around the place. And so what happens if you apply an overall electric field, the electrons are sort of like gas which bounces through. And you can get some rough properties here. And so this was, I don't know how long in terms of being taken as a serious model. Obviously, Bohr looked at it. There were some people who were seriously looking at it. And I think Bohr found some limitations with the model. But this is a very important model. And there it is, 1901 to 2016. It's sort of leapt through time, and that's what we teach people at school. But it is consistent with the Bohr model, because Bohr actually researched it, and he sort of applied that model to a single atom. So if I could take it out of a metal, and I could talk to you so much about metals, and they are so beautiful, and the quantum mechanics of it is something to behold. But we're talking about Bohr. So Bohr took a single nucleus and said, what I'll do is I'll have the electron orbit around the nucleus. So you can actually do this yourself at home. Get a piece of string, a piece of Play-Doh or something thick. Careful that you don't hurt too many people. And you have to swing it around your head. Now, that cord pulling you in, the cord applying tension between the particle and your hand, is the electric field, and that's pulling it in a circular orbit. Now, of course, it wasn't before long people began to embellish Bohr's model, and Bohr came up with this particular idea. I won't go in it too far, but Bohr said, look, you can only have certain lengths of string. They're actually, the actual strings are a certain set of ratios across. I've actually got the number on the top of my head. It's something to do with the square root of n lengths out. So let's say, I think the square root of 2, square root of 3, square root of 4, in terms of lengths out, they can go out to an infinite distance, in actual fact, with this square root function. That's just off the top of my head. I really can't visualize the formulas in my head at this point in time. I'd have to stop. I'm an R too much. But your lengths of string have got different ratios. So the string close to your head can spin very, very fast, but slightly further out, which represents the forces more gentle as you're spinning further out more slowly, and that represents the electric field dying off. And he said, look, I think that maybe the square root of R, just have to really concentrate. Oh, I can't really think as I'm talking here. But he said, look, these are integer, related to an integer number in there, and he had various ways that he could do it. And he harked back to a German who was doing fairly meticulous data, called Planck, to say that's related to the angular momentum. So if you're spinning something around your head, the unit of angular momentum stored in it. So if you're spinning it around your head really, really fast and a small radius, that's a unit of angular momentum. If you increase the radius, you don't have to spin it as fast, so it's traveling more slowly, but the fact that it's a bigger disc, bigger flywheel going around your head, is another unit of angular momentum. So he harked on the units of angular momentum. So this flat set of discs with a certain number of electrons going in it. Now, he didn't care about the number of electrons because he was only looking at hydrogen. And he was able to conjure up some basic, I suppose, high school physics. And this is why people tend to love teaching it. And I would contend that people not so much teach it, but they brainwash people into this. Brainwash it. I have to get onto that a bit later on. And so he was able to say that the electrons, what happens is you're spinning around the electron in your head, and suddenly the cord jumps out in length, and what's happened is that there's actually more energy as it's spinning at a greater distance, at a more literally speed, but a greater distance. And what's happened is that a light piece of light energy has come into it. It's suddenly magically hit out, and the length of the cord has increased. And then the length of the cord wants to get closer to you because there's that force. And so you're spinning around your head, and the length of the cord suddenly drops down and it spins faster. And as it does that, you shoot out a little particle of light. Now, all these particle of lights and all this complexity is something that he added. He sort of added the Drude model, which, yeah, I don't know, I just find incredibly disappointing. People who can't just discuss it, they get really all possessive about, oh, I've just taught it to my class, it's got to be right. That combined it with Einstein, who began to say, look, there's these little particles, and Einstein looked at this jump and the energy conservation on light he had with the photoelectric effect. The electrons jumped off out of the metal, his Drude metal. So Einstein I think had a picture of the Drude metal. But Einstein was an ideal navigator. So he could see the waves of thought short and a long distance waves and sort of navigate his way through ideas without actually touching, embedding himself too deeply in an idea. So although Einstein probably had the picture of the Drude model in his eye, in his mind, he didn't actually go into it. So the mechanism that Einstein talked about in 1905, Bohr came out, I think, 1911. The important thing is that Bohr, I'm going to have to move the story on, Bohr won a Nobel Prize, I think, in 1922. And this meant a professorship and fame and head of a school. Now, we're going to move things along, I think, to World War II, is sort of the classic Bohr period. So he's in Denmark, and of course we know that Germany is going to take on Czechoslovakia, take over Belgium and stuff like that. I think Denmark fell in 23 hours. That was the time for their motorized divisions to reach Copenhagen. And so Bohr was in occupied Germany. So this famous scientist. Now, if you can imagine a football coach as a scientist, trying to mix those two together. So Bohr had a very sort of fixed clinical idea of reality. Everything had to be concrete and make sense, and he would argue and often talk to people late at night when they didn't want to. There's many stories of people sort of eventually coming underneath his forceful ideas. So he's very strong about these ideas. And these particular ideas I've described are the ideas that we teach at the very physical, comic or naive ideas of atoms, which we teach at school. And really there's no one who knows advanced science who's got a hand down to help teachers and the education system up from the set of ideas. So it's a very comfortable idea. It's in the history books, it's in the storybooks, it's in the textbooks. But as you could well imagine, there's no electrons, it's not going in a circular orbit around your head, and the length of the electron, the distance from the electrons, are not magically jumping in and out. But that was the idea that Bohr described that as his postulates. Now I'm going to get on to Bohr as Bohr the man, because I want to actually push this in. Bohr had his Nobel Prize, and a Nobel Prize is given in Oslo. Importantly, the Nobel Prize is given for one of the motivations of the Nobel Prize is sort of benefit to humanity. So Nobel is a Swedish chemist who discovered dynamite. Famously, the story goes, in a boat, the wave rocked the boat, he dropped the nitroglycerin into the clay padding, and the nitroglycerin, which is a organic salt, very explosive organic salt, just didn't explode. His boat didn't explode, and the clay and nitroglycerin turned out to be the discovery of dynamite. So he made a lot of money. So dynamite was very important for mining, for trains, and also for war. And so the sense that Nobel promoted war, he wanted to be remembered differently and established this famous prize. And Bohr was able to use his atom, his naive schoolbook atom, to get one spectrum of one atom, but nothing else. He could get one spectrum of one atom in no magnetic field, and this, I suppose, was a bonus prize. It was using rather than a path, he would jump from stepping stone to stepping stone based on the basic principles, which were going to be uncovered later. He would say, well, this seems a reasonable principle. I don't know why it works. So he got the Nobel Prize for that. And so this is a large Nobel Prize. And this is the very first point I suppose I want to say is at the start of World War II, Germany invaded all of Poland, but didn't immediately want to go to war with Russia. And so they pulled back from the end of the Polish border and let the Russians come into Poland. This is one of the things you automatically think, oh, well, Poland is divided in two. I think Germany went up to 90% of Poland and then pulled back to 50% of Poland. The Russians then came in and invaded Poland. And so Russia had these expansionist ideas. And at this time, it's pretty amazing to get your head around everything that's happening. And it's important to see how Roosevelt, this is in the US, was keenly aware of the geopolitics, but had his hands tied. And it's very interesting to actually look at this and go back. So it's World War II. Denmark's about to be invaded. It's not invaded yet. And Russia says, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to invade Finland. And this is, Finland used to be part of the Tsaristic system, and it was an independent country, and they wanted to take new territory in Finland to actually secure St. Petersburg, I think is the Baltic port up there, get greater land support around it. There was obviously a reason for it. And at this time, Russia had a war with Japan, a small skirmish which took all its armies away. And so these armies were, the war was resolved with Japan. Japan really didn't want to fight the war. So the armies then came back up and enabled the invasion of Finland. Now, the invasion of Finland, let me try and go through. We're talking about the invasion of Finland because it's very important for Bohr and Bohr's Nobel Prize medal. But Finland, so you've got Denmark, and the other side of Denmark is, I believe, the Baltic. There's a bit of strait, and then there's a little sort of circular sea, the Baltic Sea up there, the Baltic States. So Finland's there, and it's didn't want to go into war, but the Russian really conspired to force it into war. And then it had a very expensive campaign fight against the Finns. And, of course, it meant the Finns allied with the Germans afterwards, because the Germans began punching up the Russians. And I do remember there's lots of stories you read about this Finnish war. The Russians didn't do too well. They had a lot more armour, but the Finnish had tactics and, I think, a very successful sniping campaign. But Finland was under threat, and America, well, I don't know how to really analyse it, has its tied hands tied and had a Finnish rescue fund, which got various unions and organisations and papers. So it was a high profile rescue fund, and Bohr donated his Nobel Prize medal of gold to be auctioned to this rescue fund, and someone bought the medal, and the money went to this rescue fund. This is really important in terms of building up the idea of who Bohr was. He was really cemented in the real world. He had a sense of justice, I suppose, but not a sense of the extreme pride. This Nobel Prize was a thing that, yeah, he was a figure in the public life. You can imagine doing that. Now, the Germans invaded Denmark. I said, hello, we're up here. And there were two other Jewish. So Bohr's half Jewish. The Germans invade. And so there's a bit of tension associated with Bohr's view, and he's got he's sort of a bit of a free thinker. So I suppose a lot of people either followed a political party and things like that. An important aspect of this story, because I actually thought Bohr's Nobel Prize went this way, but in fact two other people's Nobel Prizes were spirited away up to Bohr's Institute in Copenhagen. And the you have your name inscribed on your gold, and you're removing the gold out of Germany. If the Germans find the Germans are trying to get as much gold as possible and stop gold bleeding out of Germany, as people try to secrete the gold. So people have got hidden wealth. They don't want the hidden wealth to suddenly disappear. They want to keep control of it. And to really understand, I think the British heaped huge amounts of gold to pay for World War I to America. So gold is still an important thing for wealth here. So someone who's looking after these Nobel Prizes dissolves these prizes knows the Germans are going, and there's a special one only solution called Aqua Regis. It's a special acid which only dissolves gold, and he dissolved these Nobel Prizes with the people's names on, into a liquid solution, a clear liquid, and stored in Bohr's laboratory. And the Germans did actually come in and search it for who knows what, but they definitely would have picked up these gold medals and these gold Nobel Prizes, and these scientists, I think they were Jewish scientists, would have definitely got the worst of it. So there's a sort of a beautiful eye thought of it. So you've got the gold in the Drude state, all stuck together, and then the electron, the gold becomes actual individual atoms diffused in a liquid. So it's a lovely thought of that Bohr, the father of the atom, that's what he is called, the father of the atom, even though Einstein sort of nailed that there had to be exist. He's the father of the first, I suppose, good structure of the atom. As people got the clues together, he was the first person who put a general picture that everyone could recognise and say, ah, yeah, that explains everything. So that's there. And then after the war, they recondensed the metals, got restructured and restructured. So it's a good, nice little science story. It was sort of lost in history. But what's more amazing is that there, for some reason, I think Bohr fled Denmark up to neutral Sweden. Now, Finland was with the Russians, with the Germans. Sweden was neutral, but really effectively collaborating with the Germans, but slightly neutral, collaborating in terms of that when the Germans were invading Norway. So Denmark, I don't know why they invaded Norway. I have to think about it. Britain was trying to defend Norway. So Norway's a new country up on the northernmost country in Scandinavia. So if you mentioned Scandinavia is a sandwich that goes Norway, Sweden, Finland, going across in these sections. So I do know Norwegians I've spoken to complaining about Sweden, that very rarely complain, but during World War II they left on all their lights so the German planes could fly, navigate everywhere, and then drop their bombs in Norway. But it's important to discuss about flight. So Bohr fled to Sweden and went up to Sweden. So you could go to Sweden, Denmark during occupied, because Sweden was neutral. The Germans let you go in and out. I don't know how many times they do it. But the British decided that they would extract Bohr. And the way they did it is that they had a special lightweight bomber with no armament, designed to go really fast and fly really high. And it was made of wood. It was a wooden plane, but it looked like a modern war plane. It's called a Mosquito bomber. I know well because my year six, my grade six teacher was a Mosquito bomber pilot. Somehow they said there was a thing in the tail, so I think there was a rear gun, but not in these ones. So the British flew this bomber high above, and it landed from Britain into Sweden. And Bohr was loaded in a jacket and got onto a mattress in the bomb bay. And he had a helmet with an oxygen mask. And he was going to... British then flew at high altitude. And we now know it's high altitude. My first story I heard, it was they're told that they was flown at low altitude under German radar, but at high altitude above the German fighters, etc., and then taken from Sweden to Britain, where he had something to do in Britain, I suppose. Bohr really wasn't involved in the nuclear program, even though he's discovered the atom and you think the atom bomb, but he wasn't that great a scientist. Grade, not greater. He was a great scientist. He's not that great of scientist. And because he had real difficulty getting his mind around quantum mechanics, as far as I could see. Okay, so he's flying up there, and of course the pilot goes to speak to Bohr, and he can't hear anything, and so he gives instructions to Bohr, and Bohr doesn't do it. The reason he doesn't do it is that he can't get his helmet on because his head is too big for the helmet that they've supplied, and so Bohr passes out and is oxygen deprived for several hours at high altitude, and they barely revive him when he comes down. The only other story, and so Bohr survives that. So, I should say that at least one source says that the British had the instruction that if they were going to be captured, rather than let Bohr be captured by the Germans, which I suppose makes sense, if they were just to open the bombay doors and drop Bohr at high altitude. But I don't think they explained that to Bohr. And that would sort of make sense, because if they're going to be captured, they'd kill the pilot and Bohr anyway. He would probably survive. The Germans wouldn't... I don't know. They might have let the person survive, I suppose. And I don't know whether you corroborate that story. The final story that I want to talk about, Bohr, is a very famous one that people say that Bohr... So you can imagine Bohr watching this and selling his gold medal, or auctioning his gold medal. Bohr watched the American Western movies, and used to always note that in a shootout, the good guy would not draw first, but shoot more accurately, and the person would die. So Bohr had these cap guns, and around his laboratories would walk around his laboratory with his cap gun, and they'd have a drawing competition where people would try and draw on Bohr, and then he would try and shoot them back. And that, I suppose, to me, is it says a lot in terms of he's thinking about good and evil and about how people think. And he's got to deal with this. He really doesn't really understand the Schrodinger world. And this is not to be sneered at, because the Schrodinger world happened well enough after he's had a good few years working at his models. 16, probably 10 years past from when he produced his model to when they worked out quantum mechanics. So it's an excusable fact that he didn't see it. He is based back in this old view. He's also a moralistic person, and he also had to deal with Nazi in Europe and a whole lot of people who are essentially brainwashed. So my sort of philosophical view is that there's some sort of symmetry here in that Bohr had to live in a world, negotiate a war, which we could talk about Nazis and Germans, but it's essentially they're not bad because they're Germans. They're bad because they've been all brainwashed. They've all been brainwashed with a series of incomplete thoughts, and therefore they will do a certain amount of things. So I don't think there's inherently anything bad about any particular group of people, but there is inherently bad about strains of brainwashing. So I don't know whether you have to actually go to war to win a brainwash battle, but it's interesting now that his story obviously has not gone forward. No one uses the Bohr atom except in teaching, and it's only there. And so we're sort of teaching using the same brainwashing. So that there's a sort of a symmetry in there, tucked away in their symmetry. And I suppose you've got this long discussion of Bohr. Some of it may be interesting. I doubt that many people will listen to me going all the way through it. But you had, I suppose, the way Einstein collected a lot of theories together and put them together as an overall story, and got to the truth of the main idea that there was an atom, or there was a photoelectric effect, you know, that there are electrons that can be kicked out by light and electrons that get together. So basically Bohr had an atom-wide photoelectric effect. So he borrowed from Einstein, and Einstein had the general idea of special relativity and went very much on the surface by collecting a large amount of things, where Bohr took the individual ideas and moved them a little, ever so little, and got forward. I think this is what we're trying to do here, is get a big overview of Bohr, a big overview of what we're teaching, and a big overview of brainwashing kids or actually explaining things to kids. We have to really get into it. I suppose if you're in the brainwash state, you say, oh, well, what's the conclusion here? Should we stop teaching, or what should we do? There's all that beautiful complexity in there. And at the end of it, Bohr was really concerned with, or certain aspects of justice. You can see in there. He hasn't articulated, not in his writing, and I'm sure I'll go away in the next couple of months and read about it, but I'm sure there's that theme of justice there, and the theme of justice against the injustice of World War II and all the goings on, where people basically did really bad things to everybody else because they were brainwashed to do it. So that's my story about Bohr. There's a lot of interesting facts about him. I hope I've given a bit of a description which puts him back in time. And I've described a little bit of the atom, and the idea is that you've learned it many, many times, but some of the physics ideas, some of the concepts stick a little bit more, and you get a picture of, I suppose, some of the ideas taught at school are really dead-end ideas, particularly the Drude model. It's really hard to take it further on, and if you just sort of sit down with people and say, look, this is the case, you get this sort of strong reaction, sort of this emotive reaction, the feeling that I'm trying to push an issue rather than just quietly tell people what's over the horizon for them. So that's my story of Peter Hill Explains. This has been a long podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. Good night until the next podcast.